blind, have low vision, or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
This is Patricia Mary, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the Saturday, Sunday, November 8th and 9th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the front page of Off Duty, Tired of Clutter? How to Sell It for Cash. In the tariff era, the online resale market is booming. Is your basement full of potential values? We ask pros what kind of junk might sell and how to unload it for a profit. And this is by Catherine O'Shea Evans. Like many people, my garage and closets are littered with the modern day life, from stacks of paperbacks and fancy china to a fussy tea maker, still swaddled in its box. All of it needs to go. Some of it, I suspect, might even be worth something. Kath's stuff proved valuable for Justin Lee when he and his wife married in their late 30s. Joining forces meant they would have to evict one entire household full of stuff. I'm sure you can guess whose things had to go, said Lee, who was the CEO of Oro Performance Incorporated in Knoxville, Tennessee. Lee embraced the purge as an excuse to resell everything from his old designer suits to a plasma TV via Craigslist, which in 2018 was the online marketplace of choice. We crushed, he said. What would have been clutter became cash, ultimately over $8,000. We didn't go to the ATM for years. Today, in the tariff era, demand for used goods is surging. According to the 13th annual resale report from the platform ThredUp, online resale saw a 23% growth in 2024, and the market is expected to nearly double in the next 5 years. Yet, as alluring as it sounds to parlay stray coal hands or candlesticks into money, the uninitiated can find selling their clutter confusing and off-putting laborious. The research, the photos, the listings, the cryptic messages from strangers, who has the time? To demystify the steps and get a reality check, I reached out to organizing pros and veteran sellers for guidance. The bad news? Your grandma's dishes might be less valuable than you think. The good news? Your clutter could still yield surprisingly payouts if you know what to sell and how. First, do the math. Alyssa Bovino, a New Jersey-based home designer influencer known for her Facebook market prowess, suggests novices begin by setting a minimum price for their efforts. Personally, I don't have the patience to be dealing with people for a $5 item, she says. Such trifles can be donated. To get a feel for the effort required to sell bigger ticket items, Dana White, author of Decluttering at the Speed of Life, recommends you dip a toe in by listing just one thing. Say you spend 6 hours photographing, writing a list, answering questions, and getting together with a buyer or arranging shipping and make $50, she says. That's not a lot per hour. The key, the pros agree, is getting a realistic idea of what things are worth, then devoting energy strategically. Beware the endowment effect, says Joshua Becker, founder of the website Becoming a Minimalist. We all tend to overvalue the things that we own, he explained. Check with an expert. So how can you know what things are worth your time? One upside to online resale is easy access to information about past transactions, says Virginia Clemmy, author of Big Thrift Energy. White checks eBay to see what other sellers earn for items like those she hopes to unload, even if she plans to sell on another platform. Just remember, she says, asking prices don't matter. It only matters what things have actually sold for. To get a sense of the potential value of furniture and vintage housewares in particular, try creating a free account on auction sites like Live Auctioneers that let users see past sale prices. These can help gauge what buyers might be willing to spend on a comparable item. Unsure what you have or how to describe it? Bovino says a Google image search can help. Upload a photo into Google Images. Drag it from your desktop into the search window, and the browser scours the internet to find matches. This can yield info about the item's history and selling potential. For instance, if you find many similar items online that haven't sold, demand might not be there. Want more of an antiques roadshow experience? Camille suggests a little-known trick. The Heritage Auctions House Sotheby's actually has a tab on their website under Sell, where you can upload photos of your items, she says. If you have something really spectacular, they will not only tell you, hey, it's probably worth X amount, but they'll facilitate the sale on your behalf. Take stock. Maybe that bin of Beanie Babies isn't going to pay for your next Hawaiian vacation. That doesn't mean those beanies are entirely worthless. The pros I spoke with offered this common clutter cheat sheet using a spectrum from don't bother to you're sitting on a fortune. Donation only. In this category, for instance, are certain popular china patterns. The sad reality? Many heirlooms aren't worth their shelf space. I was told for years these dishes are going to be worth so much money, White said, but then you checked and nobody wants them for 99 cents. Camille added the coins and currency, like the $2 bills her grandmother once hoarded, are also rarely worth more than face value. Worth a little online research. Even if you're skeptical, always make time for a cursory Google search. Artwork and pottery can sometimes be more jackpot than crockpot, especially if the piece has a name attached. Camille once picked up a charming ceramic sun at a yard sale for $30, only to learn via Google that the stamp on the back marked it as a rare piece by mid-century potter David Gill. After listing it on Cherish, she sold it for $1,000 after 2 days. Some vintage fashion can also yield unexpected dividends. In 2023, Camille sold a 1960s caftan that didn't fit her, but turned out to be made by artist Peg Hopper for $600 on eBay. Cha-ching! Now and then, one man's trash really proves to be a treasure. Video games? Maybe. Camille recalled that a few years ago, an unopened Legend of Zelda video game sold at auction for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some old Barbies go for $8,000 and up, and holiday ornaments, especially antique and mid-century pieces, can also be quite collectible. Vintage blown glass pieces that are really colorful or shaped like fruit and go for hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, Camille says. Again, Google can be your friend. Pick the platform. Once you've decided what to sell, choosing the right platform matters. pros and novices alike favor Facebook Marketplace for low lift sales. Keeping things local streamlines the process and spares you the packaging tape. Auction Ninja allows users to conduct online estate sales. Etsy and eBay are better suited to shippable items, especially tools, electronics, housewares, and artwork. Poshmark makes selling and shipping clothes and small household items practical, as easy as slapping on a prepaid mailing label. For furniture and decor, design-forward sites like First Dibs and Cherish can fetch higher prices than Facebook Marketplace, advises Camille. This fall, furniture for entryways and home offices have been in high demand, with case goods and tables outperforming upholstery, says Noel, VP of Global Merchandising at Cherish, noting that American heritage brands like Ralph Lauren and Baker are especially sought after. Buyers pay for shipping, and Cherish offers logistical help ranging from cost quotes to actual delivery. If you are handling shipping solo, websites like Pirate Ship allow you to purchase USPS or UPS labels online to print at discounted postage rates. Just keep in mind that costs can mount, not just shipping itself, but the packaging supplies. Things like packaging peanuts, bubble wrap, heavy-duty tape, and boxes can add up to $30 to $40. Camille warns, sometimes if she sold an especially profitable item, she pays a UPS store to pack and ship that item for her, though the cost can run as much as $60 for a large painting. It can be worth it for convenience and peace of mind. Think like a salesman. When Bovina wanted to unload something quickly, like an old desk she recently sold for $675, she depends on a few reliable tricks. The most important thing is really taking clear photos in natural light, she says. Other tips, photograph the item from multiple angles and wear helpful indicated scales by saying placing a soda can near it. You want the details to be accurate as possible because that will avoid questions and potential disappointment at pickup, she says. Same goes for noting any damage like nicks or scratches. Uploading video can also help pieces sell faster, she says. For Lee, the key to getting the less coveted stuff out of his living room was strategically bundling, pairing small knickknacks with big ticket items that drew in competitive buyers. The result, he said, was a flat out feeding frenzy. My approach was, okay, you want an Armani suit for $20? Fine, but you're going to have to take the pots and pans too. An article from the fashion page? Want a great men's puffer jacket? We tested some in a walk-in freezer and a snow room. To test 6 Butsy winter jackets in the fall, our writer visited a resort's snow room and a restaurant's walk-in freezer. The handsome cold-proof winner came in under $400. And this is by Chadir Navarro. Want a down jacket that gets you through winter somewhat stylishly? Prepare to hunt. Every brand from Gap to Gucci sells puffers, but two may turn shoppers into the Michelin man. Complicated matters. Brands claim to warn wearers via proprietary technologies with names like Cloud Down, Omi Heat, RGO, which are more vague and jargony than the last. In search of stylish and practical cold weather armor, I tried 6 fuzzy men's puffers from a range of brands. I wore them on chilly mornings in New York, but since it's only fall, I took additional steps to gauge their ability to protect me from polar fortresses. My testing facilities, a restaurant's freezer, and a resort's snow room. Before I set out, I called Alexa Manella, category merchandising manager for men's outerwear at REI. She stressed the importance of the shell's material durability. Good options, ripstop, nylon, treated taffeta, or waterproof Gore-Tex textiles. Kevin Jackson, who is co-founder of EXP Journeys, leads expeditions to cold weather destinations like Alaska, flagged another consideration, fill power. Typically cited in online descriptions, this number indicates the down's efficiency at insulating. While it doesn't tell you how much down a jacket contains, models with a higher fill power will be warmer for their weight. Look for about 600 and up for winter. A quality zipper is crucial because it seals you in, says Jackson. Another tip from him, ensure your puffer contains inner pockets to preserve tech battery life in glacial conditions. All the ones I tried ticked that box. I started with the lightest and cheapest jacket. Billed as a between-season item, Uniqlo's Puff Tech Parka, $90, is not built for 0 degree conditions. The water-repellent double-layer woven fabric kept my arms dry on a stormy day when a $5 umbrella offered limited coverage, and a contoured, anatomically shaped sleeves helped me move more freely, handy when I wore it to play tennis. It uses synthetic down, which is typically cheaper than natural down, and retains heat better when wet, said Manella. A value pick for milder winter days or layering. I subjected the other jackets to icier environments. The walk-in freezer at Bass, a restaurant inside Manhattan's Evelyn Hotel, is set to 0 degrees, but can dip to -3. I spotted an icicle dangling from a pipe. Fluffy artificial snow fills the snow room at the lodge at Woodloch in Pennsylvania, designed for cold therapy treatment. It gets down to 14 degrees. Jay Hilburn's new EcoTech puffer jacket, which sells for $767, wasn't quite warm enough for the freezer, but it did the job in the snow room. While most puffers skew casual, this reads corporate, almost dressy. Its navy shell is made of slightly shiny, high-density, water-repellent taffeta. You can order it minus the hood and with different types of pockets, such as an angled zip or flap with snaps. Suave finance bros will love it. I like the sleekness of Athea's Bomber Jacket Pacer Jacket, which sells for $450. This 750 fill power jacket kept me toasty on a 45-degree mornings, but it lacked a hood and closed with buttons, not a zipper, so in the freezer it let in too much cold air. At that price, I want more warmth. Canadian Goose Chilliwack Aviator Bomber, which sells for $1,000, was the priciest, suggesting the offspring of a sleek down jacket and a shearling coat. This is one good-looking puffer with a streamlined cut and an exaggerated fleece collar, detailed with a fleece collar or fur trimmings, Jackson noted, tend to be more for show. Though I didn't get to the freezer in the 75 I'm sorry, 750 fill model, it was easily warm enough in the snow room, but it lacked the hood, and its sidewall pockets sat too high for me to comfortably insert my hands. Nobis's Supra men's performance puffers again sells for $1,000. Doesn't fool around. The water-repellent taffeta jacket, more substantial than most, kept me cozy even with the freezer at its coldest. Other features, soft lined pockets, a soft ribbed collar, an adjustable hood, a slightly longer back hem to warm the bottom when you sit, gave it a premium feel. Nobis says it can withstand minus 22 weather. If I lived in Alaska, I'd step it up. But in New York, I don't need something so quite hardcore. My winner for price, warmth, and looks, the Culian down jacket, which sells for $390 by Edinburgh brand Kristen. Made of recycled, water-repellent nylon ripstop stuffed with 600 fill powered on, the jacket has a boxy cut that allows for plenty of base layers. That said, with just the mid-weight wool sweater underneath, I was warm in both the snow room and the freezer. If I'm being picky, I didn't love the unlined pockets, but I did like the unusual onion-shaped quilting, the sky blue hue, and the fact you can cinch the hemline and hood for a snug fit. Low-key guys can grab it in black. Evan Holland, a forest ranger in the Scottish Highlands, has been rocking the Culian for about a year. He's worn it on 14-degree days with wind around 20 miles an hour, so it felt a bit colder, he said, adding that he typically wears it over a merino sweater or a micro fleece. The Culian hasn't let me down yet. If it's good enough for a guy planting trees in the part of Scotland known for bitter tempests, it's good enough for me. And the Culian is spelled C-U-I-L-L-I-N, and it was under $400. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is from The Rumble Seat by Dan Neal. The Wall Street Journal's car columnist answers your burning questions. Dan Neal on why he doesn't review more affordable cars, the 2026 model he's most looking forward to, and the practical car he most often recommends. Dan Neal receives a lot of reader mail. Here he takes an opportunity to respond publicly to a few cues. How's your artificial hip? Great, thanks for asking. I'm buying them for everybody on my Christmas list. What new for 2026 models are you looking forward to? The list of all new cars is pretty short. Among the high-profile debuts in North America are the BMW Class Series, the next generation of EV people movers, including the iX3 crossover and the i3 sedan. The Afelia AF. EELA, a mid-size sedan from a new brand called Sony Honda Mobility, a Kia EV3, and the new Honda O electric sedan and SUV. A slew of similar nameplates are getting a second act, including the EV favorite Chevy Bolt. Among fast cars, the Chevy Corvette ZRIX, a hybridized 1,250 mile per hour monster, debuts with a price tag starting just over $200,000. That ought to be fun. My son, my daughter, spouse needs a car for school, work, daily driving. What car would you recommend? I would probably answer half of my reader mail with the words, the Toyota Prius, depending on the correspondent. I might also recommend the Toyota RAV4, and the Corolla and the Honda CRV, Transport and Civic, Subaru Outback and the Forester 2. All pretty good options. Considering the dearth of options overall, I would even go so far as to recommend the Ford Maverick Hybrid pickup. But for younger workers, students, and parents of students, my advice is to delay, if not avoid, buying any car. Ownership costs have gone through the roof in the past 5 years. Auto insurance has gone up 55% on average since 2020. Repair and maintenance costs have soared 44% in 6 years. Daily transportation has become a household budget buster. For the next 5 years, I predict more of the same, partly driven by the U.S. market's growing isolation and declining import competition. Where, for example, are all the affordable compact pickups? Is it because there's no demand or that automakers can't make a profit on them? Are you finally willing to admit you were wrong about EVs? I am regularly accused of bias towards EVs. Well, yes, after decades of reporting on the matter, I conclude that electrification is a smarter, cleaner, more efficient way of moving mass personal transportation. The rest of the world agrees with me. Globally, EV sales are on pace for another record year, capturing about 20% market share in Europe and over 50% of new car sales in China. The U.S. market is fast becoming a fossil fuel backwater. We won't be seeing the latest and greatest from the rest of the world. Chinese automakers already offer luxury EVs with up to 1,000 kilometers of range, which is about 620 miles, for the cost of an entry-level Lexus. The technology to make automobiles cleaner, more affordable, smarter, and more reliable is here. More specifically, there in China. But American consumers can't get it, and American automakers have no incentive to build it. I'm not the one who's wrong. How's your solar farm? You mean my Tesla Powerwall and solar panels on the roof? Great. Since March, the system has generated about 1.2 MWHs, defraying about 12% of our 12-month household electric use and 100% of our annual fuel costs, since both cars are electric. Ask me how I would future-proof the electrical grid using rooftop solar and other renewables, home batteries, microgrids, and EV transportations. Why don't you review more cars for middle-class consumers? Your problem is my problem. The shortage of affordable, practical, reliable cars aimed at middle-income buyers. How many times can I review the Subaru Outback? Another problem is product stagnation in technology, styling, and the user experience. I hate reviewing the latest model when it's essentially unchanged from last year's model. Why don't you write more about what a car is actually like to drive? Some readers want more stick time. I take it as a compliment. Sometimes it's just a matter of word count, but often it's because there is nothing to report. Should I use precious column inches teasing out the scrubby understeer of a Toyota Sienna minivan? It's a minivan. They are supposed to understeer. Sports cars present different problems. The faster they are, the harder it is to give them a proper shake. In cars such as the Ferrari 12 Cylindri, it's difficult to even bring the tires up to working temperature on public roads. On cold tires, cars like the Ferrari don't handle, they mishandle. Those dew fuses on YouTube spinning out in their jumped up Ford Mustangs, cold tires. I do love getting a great sports car on a great track, but opportunities like last week's flogging of the new Porsche 911 Turbo S on the Certo Acari are rare and require considerable schlepping. I'm not looking for sympathy. What car do you drive? As documented in these pages, I own a 2022 Tesla Model 3 that I bought cheap. It had a hard life. In July, it was heavily damaged in a rear-end collision. The repairs totaled more than $13,000 and involved cutting off and replacing the whole rear structure and body. But it came back from the repair shop good as new and has worked perfectly since. Our other family car is an exotic, a 2019 BMW i3 electric city car with a 120 Ah battery and a range of 125 miles. This pioneering effort from BMW's eDrives division cost me almost nothing to own and operate. My biggest outlay has been for the skinny tires, which my wife, Tina, wears out like a crazed teenager. What collectible cars would you buy if money were no object? My tastes are simple. The Fiat 130 Pininfarina Coupe, the Citroën DS21, decapitable body by Henri Capon, 1931 Demolier Double 640-50, facial Vega FV3B, the kind that killed Albert Camus. You know, simple. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the food and drink page, the Home Cafe is a dinner party for morning people. I tried out the viral trend. Our intrepid reporter tried out TikTok's brunch trend du jour, transforming her kitchen into a coffee shop with creativity and hustle. Here's what she learned, and this is by Lauren Metchling. We should grab coffee. I can't think of four other words that strike such a chord of dread. In my world, mornings are for getting things done. The Home Cafe, or hashtag Home Cafe, as it's known on social media, has a nice aroma to it. The same way overflowing cheese boards dominate foodie feeds a few years ago, the act of turning your home kitchen into a cafe is the latest in cuisine you can name. I'm a morning person, so it's preferable to have a dinner party, says Christina Views, a San Francisco-based influencer who staged roughly 10 home cafes in her apartment. With young Americans drinking less alcohol and eating on the earlier and earlier side, the rise of this very special early bird special makes a certain sense. For me, the practical appeal was undeniable. I could round up several of the people I've been wanting to catch up with, kill a dozen birds with one homemade scone, if you will. The cafe's culture. Once I settled on Lauren's Latteria as my coffee shop name, I sent out invites for a Friday morning from 10 to 12. The responses were speedy. This real? You're opening a coffee shop in your home? One friend asked. What's the dress code at Lauren's Latteria? Demanded another. The vibe is really important, says Erica, a former tech worker who now spends her days tending to baking-based social media account at the Pancake Princess. Erica told me what I must do first, if nothing else, procure a roll of butcher paper. Butcher paper is the classic home cafe aesthetic. People just love the visual aspect of seeing rows of pastries laid out and labeled. Vizhou, the Franciscan influencer, helped refine Lauren's Latteria's brand. Coquettishly cute, or preppy, as my 11-year-old daughter would say, is the prevailing look. My rather minimalist Brooklyn home needed some production design. I personalized one of the menu templates Vizhou sells on her site and propped it up in a frame, each item priced at no dollars. I queued up an appropriately female aesthetic heavy playlist on Spotify and stocked up on props, felt back letterboard signs for the cafe's name and the Wi-Fi password, cozy mugs and plates from East Fork, a pretty picture from Bow Glassworks, a darling multicolored cake stand from John Darien. My daughter's friends designed the Lauren's Latteria logo on the stickers I had printed. I smacked those on a pile of go-to cups and my barista baseball cap and apron. All told, I probably put more effort into transforming my kitchen into a home cafe than I did into planning my wedding. Poor choices, P-O-U-R. No doubt many who attempt the home cafe already possess an espresso machine. I did not. So I arranged a road test, the Breville Oracle Jet, a foolproof Cadillac for cappuccino lovers, I was told. I also reached out to Jaskin Sinclair, a 22-year-old competitive barista who showed up the day before to give me a tutorial. Though the machine is programmed to foam milk to 150 degrees, 130 to 140 is the ideal temperature for latte art, he said. Once the milk is hot, you groom it by swirling and tapping the little pitcher before pouring it into the cup with the espresso. This optimizes the microfoam, which will make for better latte art. You'll figure out rosettas and tulips, and eventually you'll be making seahorses, Sinclair assured me, brandishing a latte with a design that was unmistakably a swan. I woke up early on game day and baked heart-shaped strawberry cream scones and assembled smoked salmon and salmon roe bagel sandwiches from a Ross and Daughters order placed the day before. None of my friends received a latte swan, but the crowd marveled at my outfit, lined up for warm drinks, and gobbled up the treats. My two offerings looked a little meager, so I filled it in with fruit. I stayed busy serving up one flat white after another. Across the room, a cluster discovered the novel every woman in Brooklyn seems to be reading, Heart the Lover by Lily King. The friends at my kitchen counter landed on some delectable gossip, the kind nobody would dare utter at a public cafe, much less print in a national newspaper. A little afternoon, I remembered some advice from food personality Jay Cohen, who regularly hosts as in-home bagel shop. Load up and go to boxes. To go boxes. When it's time for people to leave, you pack up a box and simply say, here's a little something for you to take home, Cohen says. Giving out food feels warm and abundant. They're halfway home before they realize you kicked them out. To go boxes in hand, my friends trickled out and wasted no time posting proofs of their morning adventure on Instagram. Later that afternoon, I received a DM from a person I barely knew. When can I come to your cafe? The hard cost was $454.37. The time cost? I don't want to know. Here's a recipe that goes along with this article. Strawberry heart scones. You just need a heart-shaped cookie cutter and ruby red strawberries. To dazzle your guests with this easy recipe from Paul Hollywood of the Great British Baking Show. The time is 30 minutes and it serves 6 in their cute little heart-shaped scones. For the scones, you need 2 1/3 cups plus 1 tablespoon of bread flour, 1 tablespoon of baking powder, 3 tablespoons of chilled unsalted butter diced, 1 tablespoon of super fine sugar, 2/3 a cup of whole milk plus more to brush, all-purpose flour for dusting. For the filling, you need 3/4 a cup of heavy cream, 4 ounces of strawberries hulled and sliced, 1/3 of a cup of strawberry preserves. Directions. Heat oven to 400 degrees and line a large baking sheet with parchment paper. Sift flour and baking powder together into a large bowl. Add butter and rub it with fingertips until mixture resembles fine breadcrumbs. Stir in sugar. Shake a well in the center and pour in milk. Mix using a dinner knife in a cutting and folding motion until mixture starts to come together. Fold dough a couple of times, keeping it tight. Tip dough into lightly floured surface and gently pat a roll to 3/4 inch thickness. Using a 3-inch heart-shaped cutter dipped in flour to cut out 5 hearts. Place on lined baking sheet. Gently repack a roll dough trimmings and cut out another heart. Add to baking sheet. Brush tops of scone with milk and bake until risen and golden, 12 to 15 minutes. Transfer to a wire rack to cool. To serve, whipped cream to soft peaks, cut scones in half, arrange a layer of sliced strawberries on bottom half of each scone, top with cream, and then add a generous spoonful of preserves. Sandwich together with a top scone half. Enjoy. From the food and drink page, sorry, pumpkin pie. This apple galette is all we want this Thanksgiving. With a spiral of overlapping apple slices, this galette is a stunner for the festive table. Layers of scrumptious almond, fig pen, and apple butter make it impossible to stop at just one slice. And this is by Odette Williams. This is one special galette. And it's spelled G-A-L-E-T-T-A. It involves a few extra steps, making almond frangipane, apple butter, and apple glaze, but that's what makes it the best galette I've ever tasted. The good news? Each of these elements and the dough, too, can be made ahead. The recipe comes from fellow Aussie Lewis Thompson. I've been admiring the elegant galettes he's posted on Instagram, so I reached out to see if he'd share a version we could all pull off this holiday season. With a background in fashion and experience working at Valette Bakery and Spring Restaurant in London, Thompson brings a unique flair to his baking. Galettes are how I got my start as a home baker. Apples are a particularly promising entry point as they are drier than other fruits and they behave in the oven. Thompson makes his dough by hand. In the recipe here, I give instructions for doing it in a food processor. For ultimate tenderness, use as little water as possible to bring the dough together. If I pleated edges feel above your pastry pay grade, simply fold the edges of the dough over the filling. For a striking apple spiral, take care to slice the fruit evenly, and as you overlap the slices, avoid overcrowding. Zoom in, take your time, and enjoy the rare opportunity to truly focus. And this is called Apple Galette with Apple Cider and Frangipane, and that is spelled Frangipane. This elegant apple galette will be the star of your festive table. It's beautiful. 2 hours and 15 minutes total time, and it serves 8 to 10 people. For the pastry, you need 1 3/4 cups of cold flour, 1 tablespoon of granulated sugar, 1 teaspoon of kosher salt, 2 sticks of cold unsalted butter, 1 teaspoon of apple cider vinegar, ice water. For the almond, frangipane, this is what you're going to, how you're going to make it. 1/3 a cup of whole almonds toasted, 2 tablespoons of soft butter, 2 tablespoons of sugar, 2 egg yolks, 1 teaspoon of pure vanilla extract, and a pinch of salt. For the apple butter, 2 medium apples such as Honeycrisp, 1 tablespoon of unsalted butter, 1 teaspoon of brown sugar, 1 teaspoon of apple cider vinegar. For the assembly, you need 5 medium apples such as Honeycrisp, 1 egg white or heavy cream for brushing, 1/3 of a cup of granulated sugar, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice. Okay, directions. Make the pastry in a food processor. Combine flour, sugar, and salt. Add butter and pulse to form pea-sized pieces. Add vinegar, then add ice water 1 tablespoon at a time until dough comes together. Flatten dough into a disc. Wrap in plastic and chill in the refrigerator for about 15 minutes. To make the frangipane, in a food processor, finely grind almonds, add butter, sugar, yolks, vanilla, and salt. Pause, pulse to combine. Make the apple butter. Peel, core, and quarter apples. Reserve peels and cores. In a saucepan, combine apple quarters and a quarter cup of water. Cover and cook over medium-low heat, stirring and mashing frequently until thick and spreadable, 10 to 12 minutes. Stir in butter, sugar, and vinegar. Roll the dough. On a floured surface, roll dough out evenly to a 14-inch circle. Carefully fold dough into quarters. Use a sharp knife to trim about 1 inch from edge to make a neat 13-inch circle. Line a large baking sheet with parchment paper and unfold rolled dough onto it. Chill dough 15 minutes more. If pleating the pastry, work with an inch border using the width of your finger as a guide between each pleat. Pinch a small section of dough border and fold it over to form a pleat. Repeat turning dough as you go to create an overlapping pleated edge. Assemble and bake. Preheat oven to 350 degrees. Core and cut apples into 1/8 inch thick slices. Reserve cores. Spread the frangipane, then apple butter over the pastry, keeping within the pleated edges or the unpleated 1 inch border. Overlap apple slices, working from outside in a spiral. Brush apples with egg white or heavy cream and sprinkle with sugar. If you have not pleated the dough, fold 1 inch border up and over apples. Bake until crust is golden and apples are soft, 40 to 50 minutes. Cool for 5 minutes, transfer to a rack. Make the glaze. In a saucepan over medium-high heat, boil reserved peels and cores in 3 cups of water for 15 minutes. Strain through liquid to saucepan, add sugar, and reduce to a glaze 10 minutes. Stir in lemon juice. Brush glaze literally over the galette before serving. Enjoy. From the off-duty travel page, How far does $1,000 take you on a trip to Miami Beach? This is by Adam Erase. We found out. In Miami, frugality takes focus. For our writer, this meant staying by the ocean, opting for bikes instead of cars, and scouting out Miami Beach's best happy hours. Last winter, nearly 3.9 million domestic tourists visited Miami, many of them hoping to thaw out on its fabled beaches. I know the migration well, as most years I, too, make the quick trip from Philadelphia to scarf down guava cheese pastries, practice my embarrassing Spanish, and recharge my solar battery. The Magic City exacts a premium for the privilege, especially on the barrier islands of Miami Beach. Vacationing costs a lot. Recently, I wondered, can you do Miami in a weekend for $1,000 or less? I put a rough plan together and tried my best. On day one, $1,000 remaining. For most Northerners descending on Miami, sun and sand rank high on the priority list. That's why I usually splurge on a hotel in Miami Beach and save by eating on the mainland, where the restaurants run more affordable and more interesting. But to spend less than $1,000, I knew this strategy wouldn't work. Since ride shares, especially with the surging prices that traffic jams trigger, would devour my budget. Staying at the beach, I realized, would mean staying at the beach, focusing on places I could reach without getting in a car, something I've never done. Ask me any other time where to leave in Little Haiti or Little River, the Gables or the Grove, and I can rattle off places with ease. But in Miami Beach, without a slush fund for stone crabs, I need to be creative. Rule one, no Ubers except to and from the airport. I landed in the morning and within 25 minutes of calling a car, which cost $36, I arrived at the Kimpton Surf Comer, a 186-room Art Deco low-rise. I didn't choose it for the dreary room with the view of the building next door or for its lovely garden, cloistered pool, direct beach access, and free amenities. The rate, $573 for two nights, including a $40 discount I got by booking through IGH app. I grabbed a bike, complimentary in two-hour increments, and rode to True Loaf, a minimalist bakery where I joined the leisure-clad locals securing their weekly sourdough. I peddled a latte, blueberry-studded pastry, and mango and passion fruit glazed mandolin for $20 over to a Maurice Gibb Memorial Park. Despite the yachts in Biscayne Bay, the park felt more like a secret neighborhood treasure than a see and be seen South Beach stage, thanks to its dog run, fishing piers, and a playground inspired by musical instruments. I ate my pastries under a shady pergola and biked back to the hotel for a quintessential Miami afternoon, following the sun from pool to beach. I had drink at the hotel's complimentary social hour under chilled Coppola Chardonnay, but beggar choosers, etc. Then walked 20 minutes to Chef Neven Patel's new restaurant, Paya. At the bar, I built a fantastic $59 meal from the happy hour menu. Hamachi crudo shinned with plums, chicken curry, and trifle brie grilled cheese with mango jam. The bar was about half full with fellow deal hounds, and the vibe screamed peak elder millennial. 6 p.m. dinner with Asante and Usher on the speaker. I walked back along the Lincoln Road shopping promenade. Gallery hopping here costs nothing, so I dropped into the street's two big art spots, Avant Gallery and Lumos Art Gallery, where I brainstormed how Paul Fuente's Chilling Tiger, a composite photograph of a louch poolside bengal, might work in my cottage at the Jersey Shore. Day two, $312 remaining. Complimentary coffee appears in Surf Comer's lobby at 7 a.m. and tastes much better than anything in my in-room Keurig will disgorge. A quick hop and I was back on my bike, riding south along the steamy Miami Beach boardwalk to a ginger spike ackee bowl, $17, at Under the Mango Tree. Practitioners of Downward Dog and their actual dogs patronize this tangerine-colored canteen. A short ride brought me to South Point Park and its pier, jutting 450 feet into the aquamarine Atlantic. After a rest on the adjacent beach, I visited the Petit Art Deco Museum. Admission was $7, where tidy galleries lined with photos, models, and artifacts detailed the French origins and American evolution of the designer movement, which celebrated its 100th anniversary this year. Leaving the museum, I went on hunt for another Miami touchpoint as beloved as Art Deco architecture, the Ventanas, or Little Windows, that sell croquettes, tortitos, and other Cuban coffee and snacks. A siphonic mix of an espresso machine hiss, a ravenous juicer whirl, and a Spanish welcomed me at my new favorite La Osa Cafe. The nice ladies who run it took pity when they saw me, the bumbling visitor, spilled an entire cafe con leche all over myself and on the floor. One handed me a replacement along with my Cubano combo, rice, beans, cevada, caramelized plantains, and succulent hunks of pork, which cost $23. Not even caffeine could help me from feeling sleepy after that lunch. I beat the darkening clouds to the hotel, dropped the bike, which had cost $10 since I passed the two-hour limit. After a power nap, I jumped on the Miami Beach trolley, the island's network of free trams, riding north to the Bass, the city's premier contemporary art museum. Admission $15. At the ongoing exhibition, The Kaleidoscope, Kathleen DeLee's sinister 2001 reimagining of Rubens' paintings. Het Plaske, a depict arms reaching out of the shadow to paw a nude. Wildflowers flash like fireflies in the brooding jungle of floral encampment number 2, which artist Ami Ree made in applying paint with her hands and nails. I continued the hands-on theme nearby a Chef Michael Salavone's Avi, tearing and dragging flatbread through warm, buttered, and rich hummus. For this trip, I knew I wanted one big dinner splurge and reverse-engineered the rest of my dining budget to accommodate Avi, where the build-your-own Tommy tasting menu cost $95. After the hummus and 7 vegetable salads, the meal unfolded with sweet and salty pistachio-dusted baklava, tender beef shaki over creamy black garlic tomun, and guava sorbet sundae. I checked my math a dozen times, but I was still nervous. Would I have to skip breakfast tomorrow? The bill seemed manageable, $156 with tax, tip, and even a drink. My tequila cocktail tasted of pomegranate and optimism. Day 3, $84 remaining. With a few hours left to kill before my flight and a few bucks to spend, I started my day at the Rosetta Bakery, and I made it all the way. And I was even able to buy a souvenir at the airport, the Book of Palms. You've been listening to the reading of articles and features from Saturday, Sunday, November 8th, 9th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from Off Duty every Saturday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Patricia Mary. Thank you for listening. God bless and be safe out there.
Coming up next to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Harper's Magazine. At 8 o'clock, we have Sports Illustrated. At 9 o'clock, we have The Athletic, a section of the New York Times. Stay with us for these readings and more through the rest of the evening. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,